So welcome everyone to the Go Within podcast. My name is Yasmin and I'm the founder of Sanya. And today I'm sitting with Mariana Kaplan. Welcome Mariana on the Go Within podcast.
Thank you. Hello everybody.
I'd just like to tell a little short story about how we met because it's such a like serendipitous moment of myself traveling and being in this yoga studio in New York and just seeing a book, like one book out of, I think there was like 500 books on this massive bookshelf. And I just saw The Guru in capitals and it just caught my eye out of all the books on the shelf. And I ended up reading that book and that's how we got connected. And as soon as I read that book, there were so many things I resonated with as a seeker and as a yoga practitioner and just someone who really wanted to get to know myself better, a student of the inner journey. And yeah, ever since I read that book, a lot of the topics which resonated with me, I feel are very relevant to the inner journey in general. And this is the Go Within podcast. So we usually start from that point of the Go Within journey and how you actually came to Go Within, because, you know, we're kind of brought up in a society which is very outer focused. So it always kind of strikes my curiosity of like, what was that shift in the center of gravity that made you so curious about your own inner world? So maybe we can start from there.
Yeah, wonderful. It's always so hard to know where to begin because when I hear you talking, I think about being a child and having these big questions. And I was raised in Washington, D.C. in the States. And those questions were not met with receptivity. Some people, right, how we stumble into the path, or I meet so many other people that say, like, I've just always felt this way since I was, 4 or 5 years old. I remember being astounded by, like, death and the terror of death. Questions of how I got here and how we were all here and having no resonance with those questions and the environment around me, except I remember always the refrain was, you think too much, you think too much, you think too much. So I just grew up believing that I think too much. And but those questions never left. And then I was actually in college. I went to quite a progressive university in the United States. And it was actually somebody who walked into my house, a little bit like you talk about being in that room and seeing a book. It was a roommate's mother. And she came in and said, you know, would you like to do a guided meditation? And I said, okay, you know, what's that? Let's do it. And I don't remember anything about that meditation, only that it was not until I was, I guess, 18 or 19 years old that I discovered that there were spiritual paths, that there were, even within religions, that there were mystical roots, and that there was actually many people around the world that had these kind of questions. And there was one New Age bookstore in that city, and I went there and it was like shamanism, and Buddhism, and Taoism. I didn't know what anything was, but I just was voracious, and I went to every Hindu thing and indigenous protests and, you know, anything that anybody was offering, just like, are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? And it never really stopped. So it never wasn't like that. But I think when I started writing books, especially as I have hopefully matured in life, you know, I saw that there's so many other people who come and they're born with these questions. Oftentimes it's a trauma that stumbles us into these questions. So many people come to the path, I found, because of cracks within us. There's this famous poet Leonard Cohen, he says, there's a crack within everything. That's how the light gets in. And it's a challenging part of the spiritual path because we then discover within these spiritual communities a heavy presence of trauma. Yet that's know, many people, it was a near-death experience, a heartbreak, child abuse, you know, more often that than that was just brought to our attention. And so in some of my earlier books, I was trying to kind of spare people, like having to recreate the wheels that I was on and the mistakes that I was making and helping. I wrote a book about discernment. It was really just trying to help people like categorize the questions. I've never felt myself as somebody with the answers. I think that life never stops expanding and there is no end. But I somehow have been somebody who loves to ask the hard questions and really dig in and find like-minded people who share in those questions. Those become my peers and my friends and my allies. And in college, that took the form. I discovered that there was a world because where I was raised and how many people are raised in their countries or towns or states, they never get a chance to get exposed to a larger world. And you know, as a child, I took just one trip abroad with my grandfather to Israel and London, and I discovered there was a world, cultures. And so in college, I found anthropology because of those people who studied other ways of knowing. And then as I moved along, then I got interested in psychology. But the study of psychology and spiritual traditions has been all of my adult life and probably always will be, again, because I see psychology as a new tradition. It's 250 years old. It's just in its baby nascent phase. And the spiritual traditions, I think that both of them have no end to possibility if we avail ourselves to their study, and then bringing the two together is the only way that I have been able to make sense of my own life experience. Survival strategy.
Beautiful. I mean, yeah, I'd love to, like, we'll talk in a second sort of more about the psychology and how that came in. But as you were speaking, I think I'm a bit like romantic about the seeker archetype. Like as you were talking about, you know, like being young and having questions, and I think it's such a natural part of being human to seek spiritually. But I think our society is just not really set up, like you said, to answer those questions. And sometimes it's just a bit too scary and destabilizing for our lives. So we kind of park them until the trauma or the heartbreak or the event that doesn't really give us a choice anymore. I remember being really young and being scared of death and asked, like, telling my mom about it. And I always tell this story because it just really made me laugh, giggle. Her answer was like, oh, by the time you're older, they'll have invented a cure for death, so you don't need to worry about it. You know, it's just like an answer that's like a perfect reflection of our society. Like, don't worry about it because we're going to live forever. Whereas the spiritual traditions like so incorporate like more of a like asking of these difficult questions and sitting with these, you know, harder aspects of our humanity. And yeah, I think one of the things that really helped me in your book, The Guru Question, was like the spiritual path doesn't like always give you the psychological tools to be able to kind of survive some of those questions that are just so challenging to be able to sit with. I think if you don't have that kind of more different perspective on yourself, it just can get really overwhelming and it can almost get too much.
Yes. I think that I had a wonderful mentor named John Wellwood. He passed away in 2019, but him and his wife, Jennifer, they were some of the first. I don't live there anymore, but I spent my whole adult life in California, and you know, where people are, at least people, we believed ourselves to be on the edge of the universe and creating new things, but they they started working so deeply in integrating Western psychology with especially with more of the yogic and Buddhist traditions. And it is so, especially if we're talking about an importation of non-Western traditions, to me at this point, it's patently clear that those traditions were formed in cultures that are highly distinct from, I'm saying Western cultures, but of course I'm talking to you in Malta and I'm in the United States, and there's, you know, endless cultures in between, but nonetheless, some of these Eastern traditions weren't developed to address a Western mindset. And again, psychology in its older forms is highly criticized by many spiritual and religious teachers. But again, these are people who are not often studying into the psychological tradition and understanding its evolution and having access to these incredible newer tools in psychology around trauma and neuroscience and body-centered psychology. And these are still very fringe in the psychological community worldwide, but they're incredibly powerful tools. And understanding that spiritual, even spiritual awakening, does not automatically include psychological integration and psychological development. It's such a critical understanding, and the lack of that understanding and the lack of personal human psychological integration in spiritual and religious leaders themselves is the cause of untold amounts of suffering.
I love what you said about psychology being in its infancy as a discipline, because even if you just look at, I mean, I don't know what year Freud died, but if you look at kind of like a book written by Freud and a book written by Stanislav Grof, like there's just such a like distinct, you know, yeah, it's just so vast the difference between them. And I think a lot of psychology, if we look at kind of where the mainstream of psychology is, there are so many things on the fringes that are just so interesting and so helpful. I actually came to psychology after doing breath work. So I had sort of these like experiences that probably like mainstream psychology today wouldn't be able to offer any sort of understanding as to what I experienced, you know, like going back and having, you know, memories of being in my mother's womb and feeling certain things about the world and about womanhood and about being born. But then if, you know, you read some newer texts, you know, like Stanislav Grof and other books, then that kind of makes perfect sense and it can really give you the tools to integrate it. So yeah, just as you were speaking, it kind of made me realize, like, you know, we kind of sometimes tend to generalize as well, like psychology is this, but it's such a broad and also like really super evolving discipline.
Yeah. And like, you know, like anything, I think in over the years in grad school, you know, people tend to criticize Freud, right? He was such a pioneer, but of course he was, in spite of people's critique, more his putting psychology on the map there's been more writings relating to him, infinitely more, just disputing him, which I would consider developing him. It's not, why am I going to dispute somebody? And, you know, I don't remember when he was around, you know, 1800s. Why would I dispute him? You know, he just put something on the map, and then it's ours to grow. And again, there's a lot on the fringe of psychology, and some good part of what's on the fringe of psychology can be very, I don't want to over-label, but, you know, super new agey or fluffy or kind of spacey. But then other things are incredibly, you know, grounded and modern and informed by science and evidence-based and, you know, just beginning to be offered.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, like my mind goes to the somatic, like not just somatic experience, but just like somatic therapies in general. And I think, in fact, I really wanted to discuss this because a lot of people think of psychology as just talk therapy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the importance of the body and the somatic experience is something that I've only really recently been exploring myself, like maybe over the last year or two. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about that, like what is the somatic approach? And you, I think you were one of the first people to study this when it was created.
Well, I wasn't one of the first. It just wasn't, it wasn't on the popular radar. So since the pandemic, it's incredible because trauma, so the word somatics or body centered will often be paired with trauma healing modalities. And they're paired because they work together about understanding that our psychology lives inside of our body and trauma lives inside of our body and everything that we feel and that has ever happened to us lives inside of our body. And these are processes that take psychology like down from the head. They include the mind, but bring psychology into the body, or another way of saying it is like psychology from the inside out. And I stumbled upon it because of my own need. As with everything else, I had been, at this point, I was maybe 15 years into my explorations. I had been in shamanism. I had been in Buddhism. I had lived in India at an ashram for a year and another American ashram for 5 years. And had my master's degree in psychology, and still I was not healing things inside of myself that I wanted to heal. And I was working with clients and I wasn't seeing the results that I wanted. Talk therapy, which is what's probably most widely practiced throughout the world. The somatic practices are woven into talk therapy, but talk therapy just being like, you know, let's understand what happened to you in your life and your history and understanding why we are the way that we are. And it's a piece of the journey, but it's just a piece of it. For many people, it's a super important piece because we've kept our stories inside. We may be holding shame. We don't even know that what we think about is okay, that everyone feels rage and everyone feels terror and everyone feels these things. So it's a big piece of it, but I was just hitting a wall because understanding all of these things and understanding that I became this way because of this trauma, it wasn't changing. It wasn't changing my lived experience. It wasn't changing how my patterns were operating in life. And it was about, I don't know, it must have been about 15, 17 years ago, I ran into a friend who was doing something about somatics. So I called him up. He was at the university in San Francisco. And I said, can I come in for a session? I want to experience this. And I went into the session. He was a colleague. And all I remember from the session was him interrupting me and saying, what are you feeling in your body as you're describing that? And I was sitting there saying, like, why is he interrupting me and not letting me tell my story and asking me what I feel in my body? And I don't really feel, I have no idea what I feel in my body. That was the whole session. And I left that session. And as the week or so after occurred, I thought, this is the best therapy I've ever been to. Don't know why. And then I signed on for one of the trauma healing pioneers. His name is Peter Levine, and I signed in for his 3-year somatic training. But it was a very involved training. They don't just teach you, you practice. They help you enter into your body. They help you learn to locate pleasure and wellness and wholeness in your body, which is a vehicle by which we can safely and sensitively near some of the wounds that are harder to get to in this whole process. And having been so many years in the yoga world, and even though, right, I could stretch my body and I could get high meditation states if I was lucky, and dark nights of the soul, it was the first time that that like the emotional life, and I was already a clinician, a psychotherapist. It was the first time that like emotions and sensations, it was the first time I could actually move emotionally in my body. So I was on fire. And for me, bringing that into these spiritual practices and the meditative traditions, it was like the missing ingredient in the soup I had been cooking all the years. But then what surprised me in those years is people who were also starting to explore meditation and things like that, because there was mostly doctors and nurses and psychologists, they would raise their hand in these large trainings and say, well, what's the relationship between what we're doing and spirituality? And the people in front of the room would say, I don't know, you know, somebody want to start a study group about it. And I was sitting there saying like, whoa, like what is not the relationship? Like this is what was needed for me to make sense of everything. We could talk, we could meditate, we could understand, but feeling the emotional life of the body, for me, it was the game changer. And because I used those 3 years to work with my mentors in the program and try to consciously integrate what we were doing with especially with yoga, and not just the physical practices, but the meditation and the breathing. And but that was, you know, that was one chapter. And I think if we're doing our lives well, each developmental stage, because there's this thing about human development that wasn't really accounted for in the spiritual traditions, that you can have these great awakenings and you can write about these states and the maps to them. But then the people who write about and teach these things start going through different developmental stages in life, you know, roughly corresponding with the decades. And, you know, the young woman or man becomes, you know, ripens into their sexuality, or they ripen into their, you know, they start getting into relationships, and, you know, that brings the same awakening has different implications. And then people get older and they experience illnesses or cancers, or their parents, you know, their parents die, they have children. And we want to think that these states are so kind of, we'd like to think that they're so permanent. Then these developmental markers come and rock our worlds. This famous Buddhist teacher in the United States called Jack Kornfield, he was famous for this quote saying something like, if you want to know how enlightened somebody is, you know, ask their partner. And because the first wave of those guys went to Asia and they spent all these years in monasteries, they came back and then they partnered and started having children, and then all this shit hit the fan. And
yeah, I mean, you know, as you're talking, I'm just like, you know, the spiritual bypass. Like, it's, maybe we can just, you know, spend a moment talking about it, because, again, you know, I obviously relate a lot to what you're saying in my own life, and can see how easy it is to just kind of stay within the bounds of your spirituality and stay safe in that place of meditation and kind of keeping the world at a bit of a distance. But the world doesn't really let you do that for very long. Like, at some point, there's going to be some... I was listening to this podcast the other day with Liz Gilbert, and she was giving this talk at a conference, and she was talking about suffering and how important pain is for our wisdom. And this young woman in the audience put up her hand, like she was maybe in her 20s, and she said, like, oh, I really want to be wise, and I just feel like I haven't had any suffering, so, you know, maybe I should go and seek it out. And her response was like, don't worry, it will find you, it knows where you live, just be patient and it's coming. And I just thought that was so sweet, to just like, it is so inevitable. And I remember in my early days of spirituality hearing that, like, the Buddhist tradition says that life is suffering. And I remember thinking, like, no, that they just haven't, you know, how, like, grim, you know, like, to see the world that way. Like, surely we can figure it out and become so functional that life is never suffering. Cue rude awakening. Exactly, as you said. And, yeah, I think it's just so helpful, again, going back to that spiritual journey, to learn how to hold these things, as you said, in the body. It's just so easy to stay in the mind or stay in the meditation, that there's kind of a parallel there, yet we're actually really bad at feeling our body and actually sitting with our emotions.
Yes. When you were just, I love that example from Liz Gilbert, right? As you go on in your life and you're suffering, it's like, please do not seek out your suffering because it's going to find you anyway. Like, just, you know, like enjoy the view for a moment. And I was thinking as you were talking, I remember being in Hawaii where I did my yoga training and we were at some dance outside and there was one of these, I had just been through a 3-year kind of autoimmune disorder that I was healing from. And there was this young woman dancing and she had a huge tattoo on her lower back that said invincible. And I was thought, I don't think so.
I have to confess that in my school leaving book when I was like 18, you know, everyone has like a sentence written about them, like what's going to happen to Yasmin in 10 years time. And mine was, it's so funny looking back, was to remain invincible to the effects of alcohol and cigarettes for the rest of her life. It's so cringy thinking back to it. But yeah, like totally, like we want to believe that we're invincible, but...
But this piece about how we stay in the comfort of our, you know, maybe spiritual practice or religion, part of it is, I think part of it is, yes, we, and even with in the religious traditions, there's actually, not all human beings experience this deep longing to know. I think all human beings experience a deep longing to be happy, to be free of suffering. But many of us want somebody else to have the answer, right? It's so much easier if there's like a priest or a guru or a somebody that really knows, and we can just fall into that because it takes away, you know, the
responsibility.
Like there are all the wise ones and I will seek them out the rest of my life. But it has to bear on our own inner experience. But I think that many of us, we don't stay stuck in whatever we have because we want to. We stay stuck because we haven't been introduced to any alternatives. Like, you know, I got lucky that I was living in Northern California and you know, what if in the early 2000s ran into this word somatics. I just got lucky. Like why, or most people in the world who are in their own countries and cultures and working for survival, we don't know. And we don't know because our leaders don't know either. It's right. We're in an evolving world and we're in a, right. It seems to me like in a very intensified period because of all of this technology and world culture and internet, right. The whole world is changing so much. So sometimes it's a matter of, just getting access to new teachings. And at the same time, you talked about the word spiritual bypass, and even though you say it casually, again, it was the same, a friend of mine, John Wellwood, he actually created the term back in like 76, I think. And I like to bring him up when we talk about it because people forget. I always like to kind of pay homage and honor to our foremothers and forefathers. But just for the people listening, it refers to the way that we use our spiritual practices and ideas and concepts, but it can really be anything. We can use even our psychological ones or anything to avoid or get around emotional needs and vulnerabilities and a shaky sense of self and self-esteem and these very, very human, human, gritty, unavoidable parts of our development.
Can I also add another one into the list of bypass tools? Like, because in Malta, spiritual practice actually isn't that common, but what I see like from our culture is like we use a lot of material things to bypass as well. And like here, people are so addicted to Netflix. And I find it really interesting that like we're kind of keeping our own emotional lives at bay, but then we're like so keen to live like very intense emotions through other people's lives. And I think that's also like quite a bypass, you know, it's just like so much easier to watch someone else's life than to like actively engage with your own.
Yeah. Yes. And I was reflecting on that just a few moments earlier in our conversation, because a lot of what happens for, I mean, no human life escapes suffering, but for some of us, and you know, many of us who end up at probably your place, and or you know, at Sanya and other, like, we've been cracked open and the questions won't leave us. But I think the majority of people, when those cracks start, the tools are just about shutting down. And right, we're giving examples of, I mean, spiritual practice is a kind of elegant one, or Netflix, but just alcohol, nothing, just shutting down our emotional world, right? And just so many people just try to just like keep things at a surface level. Like that's the best response to the, right, the inherent vulnerability of being human, is people just clamp it down in all the different ways. And that's where this wonderful metaphor in yoga, it's like a golden gilded cage they talk about. And, you know, we're in a cage, and maybe we're in a horrible cage, and it's ugly and it's full of addiction and dirt. But maybe we're in a gilded cage where, you know, things all have their nice place and are, and it's
shiny,
so put together that we kind of forget that we're in a cage, because it's the kind of cage we wanted to, it's the best we could do in the cage, in the caged world. And to not only to step out of that, but to keep stepping out of that, like all day, every day, or at least most of the day. Because really to stay awake to our evolution requires a daily choice, and a choice throughout the day. Because even if we're really attempting to stay awakened to possibility, the power of our deep psychological conditioning, you know, there's a lot that's going to bring us back and you know, tempt us to kind of go into the slumber of whatever is around us, and whatever our culture and our religion and whatever is around us. That's right, like that's the momentum. So to want to grow and not get enlightened, not get awakened, because that, for me, that's just like when I first met my guru so long ago, he said that, you know, enlightenment is the beginning of the path, not the end of the path. And I thought, oh, this whole thing that I've constructed this big path about, if I were to get that and that's only the beginning, that kind of knocks things on its head. And I couldn't think of anything more true. I mean, there's no end to human growth and evolution and spiritual growth. And that, you know, that I would stake my life on.
Yeah. It could also be nice to sort of, like, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, we can't just have spirituality and we also really need psychology, but maybe we can also spend a moment on like what spirituality has to add as well, because like just dealing with your biography and your trauma can be very limited and draining. And I find myself sometimes like going too much onto the spiritual side and maybe sort of bypassing some human stuff. But then sometimes I also find myself getting like too bogged down into my own stuff and my own story. And sometimes then when I come back into the spiritual practice, it's just like, oh, you know, I don't need to take myself so seriously. And there's a sense of also like kind of refueling that energy. And obviously, like here in Malta, that's really interesting because we have really Catholic roots. But the island as a whole has a really sort of beautiful spiritual heritage. And I feel like our, especially my generation, you know, we have this history of our elders being very devoted. You know, for many people, there's just been a loss of translation and how those ancient teachings translate into the modern life. And so many people are just at a bit of a loss as to how to connect again to that, to their soul and to ritual and to bringing the sacred into something that is tangible and meaningful for their lives.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but.
Of course. And I mean, thanks to you, I've been introduced to this entire country. I'm getting introduced and learning. I so enjoy learning about it. And here's like Malta's unanswered questions. And what I like to do is just show up and ask the questions. I'm grateful that I don't have to be a teacher and be somebody who people are looking for the answers, because I don't have them. And that's a very particular and hard job for people to have to assume somebody is someone who has the answers. I much prefer to be someone who has the questions. But what I hear in your point is that I think because I've had to do so much work to bring psychology into spirituality that we've erred on that side. And I would balance that by saying, like, in my own life, if I had only studied psychology without the spiritual traditions, I don't know. I think I just imagine like kind of crawling around on my living room floor here, just like slugging around decade after decade, more psychological questions. Like, it sounds just horrendous. And I think, you know, I've never been without either. Well, my whole childhood, but, you know, once I was 18 or 19, it was just both. It was like, you need food and water, and one's not one and one's not the other. They're just both. And honestly, if I had to choose one, which we don't, I would still go for the spiritual and the mystical, because psychology doesn't teach about awakening. It doesn't have maps to the inner dimensions, to you know, our consciousness and how do we navigate that. And I mean, I was raised and still practice Judaism, but like many Jewish people, I went to the like the yogic and Buddhist traditions because the maps for meditation, they're in my tradition, but they're much harder to access, and they're much easier to, like, I think people love yoga and they love Buddhism because the maps are more clear and accessible. And even if you don't know anything about the deeper dimensions of yoga or anything, and if last thing you have to do is be flexible, but if you go into a class with a good teacher and you just follow the instructions about some breath, and like, it opens, it starts teaching from the inside. So I think, you know, if we're blending the psychology and spirit, it's like the psychology would be like inside of the hold of the awakening traditions, because without them, I don't know. It's like when we talk about endless possibility. Yes, we can endlessly mature and deepen psychologically, but really in terms of like wisdom, right? And the wise ones, whether they were, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or Nelson Mandela, like they all had mystical, they all came with Mother Teresa, they all had their spiritual insight that was guiding them. And even great athletes, right? Not all of them, but you really find this. So, you know, your question of how this could transpire. I mean, it's not in Malta, like, you know, in the States, it's a parallel, because people just stop going to churches and synagogues, and the younger people don't go because they're disillusioned. You know, the media is just giving us too many options to want to dig deeper. But like how your culture, right, can, right? People wouldn't be just diving into Netflix and other people's lives if they had the tools and the awareness and the energy around to say, here, come deepen, come here, right? And if that was accessible and being carried forth. I think if people could really choose, would I rather be like wise and awake and being of service, or just, you know, shut down and in my addictions, right? They would choose. They would want at least, you know, try to choose a higher path, but they're not available, right? They're not being given. I couldn't walk, you know, I do it wherever I travel in the world, including my new state and here in the United States. I go into different synagogues and churches, and I usually have to try to slink out halfway through, because I can't hear somebody just saying, you know, God, this and this, and repeating, right? It doesn't land. Having the church is no guarantee, or the synagogue or the Buddhist center is no guarantee of spirit.
Yeah, I so resonate with that. And if I look back, I remember writing a post on Instagram once about how I think like the most treasured moments of my life were those mystical experiences that really kind of moved me out of my normal state. And they've happened in many different places, including churches and including places, connected to the religion of my birth. But I don't think I would have been able to access them without the maps that other traditions offered me. And like, I think I was talking about this with a friend recently, because at Sanya, we have like Chinese tea ceremony, which I've never even been to China, but that practice like really opened up so many spiritual experiences for me. And then we have yoga, and then we have meditation, and then we have floating, and then we have, psychotherapy. And like, we're so blessed to have all of these different tools, which they can't flip the switch on a mystical experience, but they can kind of lay the groundwork that at some point you might experience something bigger than yourself. And I just love that we're living in a time, if this was Malta like 50 years ago, I mean, they were still, talking about yoga as there was something really, really dangerous and, something you should really avoid. And there are still people in Malta who feel that way, that it's satanic and that it's, bad and it's going to take you to the dark side, which, that's like a whole other topic. But I just want to echo your sentiment of like, me personally, my spiritual experiences have been just such a important part of my life journey. And I'm looking forward to taking you to a few of our sacred spots that we have here on Malta and Gozo when you'll be visiting soon.
Thrilled. I love to pilgrimage into all the traditions. But you say something right now that's interesting, because the spiritual experiences are like the most treasured. And I think many people would say that. And then if we go back to this Liz Gilbert piece, like our deepest sufferings, I think many people would agree, have forged the most like wisdom and empathy, because it's the sufferings that dismantle us. And when we get dismantled, and then like a capacity for empathy and a experience of ourselves is not as separate or other comes. And then the piece we haven't talked about is the relational, and like the human relationships, whether it's partner to partner, and parent to child, and that those relationships bring some of the deepest fulfillment. So, and it's sometimes nice, like it's all one mysterious life, but it's kind of interesting to separate the threads, because yes, if I think what were the most sublime experiences of my life, I'll be there on the beach with Hawaii and yoga and temples in India, or even when I was at the Western Wall in Israel and I was 7, I said to my mom, like, I feel like I could cut this air with a scissors. Why do I feel that way? And of course, she didn't have any answer, but it was just my first experience of energy. And I was like, oh, there's energy. So we have these treasured experiences, and then we have the like humility and empathy, and that suffering, if we don't shut down to it and shut down around it, brings. And then the relational piece, which is often the most challenging of the whole piece. And right, we can just acknowledge that it's rightful that we would be learning about these different dimensions of life from different sources. I don't think expecting, one human being, that's what's maybe developed in my view over the many years, because I started having my guru. He died many years ago, but 10 years ago, but I started, that was like 20, 18, 17 years ago. Is that now it's like, why would I expect everything to happen with one teacher, one rabbi, one priest, one guru, you know, like let somebody teach me awakening, and let the people that are wise about relationship and psychology teach me about relationship, and let human beings who have suffered and study that and learn from it, you know, let them help me understand my suffering. And yes, maybe people have, you know, many layers of giftedness, but, and then it's one's inner guidance. And that, again, this is a tricky topic, because there's many voices and energies inside. So figuring out what we're listening to when we listen to our innermost self is no small task. And yet, for me, I had an autoimmune disorder for 3 years in my 30s. And I was, this is not the only time, but I was at death's door for an extended period of time. And I had been going to Ayurveda, and I had been going to Western medicine and infectious disease specialists and holistic MDs. And it was a couple of people, again, the same friend, John, it's so nice that he keeps coming up. John Wellwood, and then another friend of mine who I ran into in South Africa, both in their own ways, they were elders, big brothers to me in those years, and both of them in their own way said, you're going to have to go inside and find an inner source of healing. And, you know, one of them said, like, all those doctors, like, you can't rely on them. Like, you're going to collect information, but you have to be like the central source of that. And similarly, from a more African perspective, my friend Roger said, you know, there's a healer that lives inside of you, and you might not believe me, but you're going to have no way around having to find that. So I encourage you to look. And that's, you know, that's when I got deeper into yoga, because I was 2-3 years into that. And then I thought, okay, because I also had been in California, and maybe not so much in Malta, but all these new agey traditions about your guides and your angels and you're this and you're that. And that wasn't landing for me. I need things to be really real. But that was enough encouragement. So I said to myself in those years, I said, well, if I had an inner physician, like what would it for this illness that has all these names, but no real cure, like what would I need? And I got water, like warm water. And then it was like, and a place where there's not like lots of different, parasites, because I had been in many warm tropical climates, but I needed clean. And then it was like, and something about yoga, because just because you get taught yoga, you know, to unlock the deeper dimensions again is not as easy. So I was actually leading a trip to India. I used to bring graduate students from the university to these India pilgrimages. And one of my students said, okay, you know, if that's what you need, you're going to go to this island and you're going to study with this teacher, and I'm going to make it happen for you. And she was like a very shy young woman. And that was the moment in this course where she just rose up, and her inner wisdom, you know, was caring about mine. And she was my young student. I said, okay. You know, it was like some like grandmother or earth person telling me that this was, you know, this is how those intuitions were going to go. And, you know, that's how I found my, yoga teacher, who's one of my best friends and collaborators, and mostly healed myself in those years through yoga. And if I ever stray too far away from it, my body and mind just register that that's happening, and usually just knock me down in some way or another. And
there's so many like ways we could take that, because there's just so much wisdom in there to unlock. I think it made me remember sort of like one of the things that I've learned from you so far is kind of this idea. And I guess you made me realize like how many aspects of my life I was compartmentalizing, like, okay, this is my spiritual life. Okay, this is my relationship. Okay, this is, you know, and just this kind of like bringing them all together in that center of yourself and kind of relating to them without these separations that we tend to do. I always also giggle at myself when like I catch myself saying like, oh, it's option A or option B, and then I hear your voice saying like, there's also option C, D, E, F, which is
L, X, Y, those ones.
Triple Z, D. And also it just reminded me how, like, to go back to what you were saying earlier about kind of these inner maps. I actually first heard this concept in one of Ken Wilber's books about, you know, this idea that, like, the outer world can be mapped so easily. We can measure it and we can, you know, it's like all sort of measurable. But when it comes to our inner world, there's no map. There's no, like, I can't follow your map. I can't follow anyone else's. I can only create my own map. But how actually other people who have made their own map can also sometimes just, like, point you on a right turn or just kind of give you some word or comment that can really inspire your journey and really help you. And I really just love that concept of, like, you know, this, like, we need to create our own map to our inner world, and we're so blessed that we have so many tools at our disposal nowadays. I mean, primarily of which, I mean, for you and for me, like, the psychology and the yoga have just been these, like, mother and father figure to help you to create your own map.
Yeah, the map is an interesting metaphor to play around with, because I deeply agree. And it's like the mystical part of the great religious traditions, like they're trying to, you know, they serve that function. They're trying to make general maps so that we have direction. But it's like when we abdicate responsibility, like, okay, ching, I'm just going to go, you know, to synagogue every Saturday and follow these rules, and that's going to get me to that destination. But, like, they try to make their maps, and right, you don't want to, like, just start making a map and not even, like, see what other maps are going on. And what's been interesting in my particular work, because of these books and coming at it at a young age, I've ended up, as part of my psychological life and work, is that I've worked with countless spiritual practitioners and spiritual and religious leaders. And when these very many fallouts happen and scandals and breakdowns, I've ended up being with, you know, the partners and the exes and the children and the factions. So, you know, it's been a grace that I mean, when I work with people, that's what I want to do. I want to help them unlock their maps. But because there are also many, many, many similarities, right? Our life is unique and our path is unique. And that at the same time, we're made of the same stuff. We're made of consciousness and earth and you know, whatever we might believe ourselves to be made up of. Like, we're very unique and we're very similar. So what I... As the years go by and I am with so many people making their maps, you find trends. I think that's what people were doing when they were trying to create, you know, different traditions. They were trying to find trends so that, you know, and articulate them just to, like, as signposts. It brings me to this moment. There's this wonderful elder yogini. Her name's Angela Farmer. Do you know who she is? She's in Greece. She lives over your side. And I had her speaking at this big yoga psychology conference I organized in San Francisco. And she and her husband had been with this famous teacher, BKS Iyengar. You know, he was one of the great articulators of modern yoga. And they were some of his early teachers. And then they started discovering, like, the inner dimensions of yoga. So they started expanding and about, you know, what they were understanding beyond the postures. And then they were immediately kicked out. And they would talk about when they teach, they said, you know, we went from like 350 students in our classes to five. And, you know, I caught Angela, like, you know, 20, 30 years after this point. And so she's up on the stage in this conference and she's like undulating and calling out things, and we're howling, but not in this weird new age way. Like, she was really, like, doing the grandmother leader thing. And she's, like, taking us through all these things. And she said, you know, the body has this endless possibility for unfolding. And you know, once upon a time when this was happening, you know, somebody landed on this and they called it, you know, warrior. And then they kept unfolding in its natural, endless ways. And then they called this one chair pose, you know, Indian names. And she was just making this huge point. And she said, like, again, it was like, yes, it was codified so that it can be like translated and taught and practiced, but it's not the thing. It's just, right, it's just the direction. So I love thinking about that moment because she really, really brought it home. And I think ever since then in my yoga practice, I shifted from like holding poses to like just kind of pulsating, because she engraved that into us. And it was like, the body is own wisdom. The yogis were out there, you know, in the caves or and their bodies were unfolding this, you know, and they were just trying to make a name so that they could talk about it.
It's such a good metaphor as well for just like our tendency to just be rigid with any answer that we find, like anything that gives us a little bit of help, then we just sort of cling to it and make it gospel and then get really stuck and kind of close ourselves to the next flow, the next wave, the next iteration. As you were talking, I also just remembered I got like super addicted to this song this week. and it's a really sweet song. I don't know if you've come across it, but the title is Jesus, I Love You and I Love Buddha Too. Mm. And it's just got some really sweet lyrics and like one of the paragraph just goes, you are unnameable, you are unknowable. All we have is metaphor. That's what time and space are for.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah, just like, yeah, the whole sort of, you know, metaphor and like being able to kind of take the beauty and the wisdom without that rigidity and that like, okay, now this is, you know, solid reality. I think it comes, and I definitely got very rigid in the beginning of my spiritual path, and it was really something that I had to grow out of, and I'm probably still growing out of in some ways. But it does feel like a bit of a, yeah, pattern that so many seekers go through of like, oh, I found this, now it helped me and I'm clinging to it and I'm like practically squashing it or squashing myself to fit into it.
And our teachers will be, you know, willingly make the rules. And, you know, there's both the point that we touched on earlier before, like, let's recognize the part of us that would really rather abdicate responsibility and be, you know, believe if I do this and this and this every day, then this will, you know, lead to that. So, right, we give that power away. We can say it's taken from us, but we also give it away. And if you know, that example of Angela and her husband, Victor, when you dare to veer from this, it can make a lot of waves. I have, you know, many friends who have been cast out of, you know, even leadership in the church. And I'm in this particular moment because we're Jewish and in Judaism at age 13, there's this initiation for the children about a bar bat mitzvah. So I'm bringing my son, you know, preparing for this. And yet the tradition that I was raised in is so profoundly negating of women. And so, I mean, women have just been kind of written largely out of the tradition in a way that for me, I've never, as a child, it was kind of why I jumped ship. And I love my tradition, but I'm using this example because, okay, so now I go to say, well, I want to go do this ceremony and we want to be in a synagogue. Yet, you know, 3/4 of the prayers we're going to have to adjust. I'm not really going to be able to have my son lead a synagogue that talks about the fathers and the 4 sons and I just can't do it. And, you know, you're not welcome in a lot of places if that's your attitude. If you dare to follow, right, the guru, the teacher, it's there, right? It's the early poems that I learned. It's like, light my light from your light. It's like, don't make me just live in your light. Like, light my light from your light. You know, remove the flames, remove the veils covering my heart. I started seeing that poem. But then we light it, and there's not always space for that in our families, in our religions, in our spiritual paths. It's tricky business.
I'm very tempted to like jump into a whole topic about like the importance of renewing our spiritual traditions. But yeah, we're going to have a lot of time to talk about that when you come and visit us soon. We've been chatting for kind of an hour, so we'll kind of, close the circle. But yeah, let's just say a couple of words about your workshop, because you're going to be visiting Malta on the 24th and 25th of June to give a workshop here. I'm very excited to show you our ancient megalithic temples here, because they are all built in the shape of the goddess of fertility. So they were all actually matriarchal temples, and they're the oldest freestanding buildings in the world. They're actually more than 1,000 years older than the pyramids. And that's the sort of, you know, mainstream sort of accepted age. You know, some people speculate they could be even older. And it's beautiful how even our Catholic tradition then still evolved to be very, very matriarchal, even in its Catholic expression. So many of our churches, you know, devoted to Mother Mary, a national holiday on her feast. We've got a lot of folklore, which I will share with you when you hear about, you know, miracles happening on that day. So we really have a really beautiful heritage, spiritual heritage here of the Divine Feminine. But yeah, your workshop, like you're going to be hosting this workshop on all of the topics we kind of discussed here, yoga, psyche, you know, bringing that into the body through the somatic practices. So yeah, great for anyone, you know, spiritually seeking, people from the worlds of yoga, psychology, just people who want to create a map to their inner world in any shape or form. Do you have anything to add to that? Probably should have let you give the description, but I got a bit excited.
Yeah, I would only say we will touch on, there's so much there, but what I think a couple pieces that one of the wonderful things that Peter Levine, who founded the Somatic Method, he worked 40, now maybe he's on 50 years, like just codifying and simplifying the method so that it's felt, it's experienced, it's transferred, and people can replicate it for themselves. So I definitely want to just, you know, share that little nugget. And I always do that in the context of yoga and practice. But I'm most excited just for this exchange. Like I love countries, like people love whatever their hobby is, you know, they're into watches or books, or, you know, for me it's countries and cultures. So the exchange is like the whole thing for me. So I look forward to learning. And what another thing that people come for is not just the maps, but I think we want each other. It's like we want to connect. And one thing that I really do my very best to do in any training that I'm teaching about anything is make it easier and make some bridges so that people can relate to each other and exchange and, you know, find new friends and peers on the path and celebrate and share, so that we don't feel like, one of the things about yoga classes that's been kind of challenging, I think it's Sonia, you do these tea ceremonies and all these other things, is like we have all this longing, but we don't just want to know ourselves. We want each other. So we go to a yoga class and then we practice quietly our meditation, you know, and then we leave. And then we've been with all these like-minded people, but we've never gotten to exchange names and things like that. So I know you and I have talked about including a sunset on the beach. So I want to just really cultivate it with you as a time for connection and exchange and friendship, and add that more feminine element, if you would, into the offering.
Beautiful. Couldn't have said it better. I'm really glad that you added that touch of connection, because you're right, it is so important. And that was actually one of the main reasons I founded Sanya as well, you know, not just to give people tools, but to also be a space where people can learn from each other. Whenever we finish our tea ceremonies, people always share their experience of, because we drink tea in silence for like, you know, 30, 40 minutes, and then everyone shares their inner experience. And like the wisdom that people share, I always just like, well, I wish I could just like bottle this up and like send it out there into the world, because it's so nice just like hearing everyone's unique ways of expressing these cosmic metaphors. So yeah, Mariana, thank you so much for this chat. So looking forward to being here with you and having you at Sanya. And to everyone listening, thank you so much. As always, if you feel this episode resonated or touched you in any way and you'd like to share that, we super appreciate it. And also feel free to send us any feedback. It's always nice to hear that people are listening and what bits they resonated most with in this episode. So thank you, everyone, and see you next time. Mm-hmm.